From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to America's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM, and thank you, you make it happen. Next hour, regression therapy with Dr. Eric Fisher. Maybe, just maybe, you did have a past life. You might find out what it was, too, by the way. Well, this is an all too common story. A prominent physician in San Francisco who worked in nuclear medicine is dead, stabbed to death. 64 years old, discovered on the floor of the entryway of his Hilltop home on Goldmine Drive. Hospital officials concerned that he just didn't show up for work. They didn't know what was going on, so they alerted his personal assistant. Police are still baffled. They just can't figure out why Dr. Robert A.J. Lull is dead. They say everybody liked him. Police say there was no sign to force entry into the four-bedroom, two-story home, but one unusual clue was plainly visible out front. Cherry pits marked by yellow evidence tags were found scattered in front of the walkway leading from the street to the door as well as inside. They hope that they can find some DNA from these cherry pits. Somebody might have been eating cherries when they were committing this dastardly deed. Now, though this wasn't specifically a bioscientist like we have been following with Stephen Quayle, he was an expert in nuclear medicine, and he had been the chief of nuclear medicine at a hospital since 1990. It's just, again, another very strange story. Well, ignoring a veto threat, the House moved Tuesday toward approving a bill loosening President Bush's restrictions on stem cell research, with supporters claiming prospects were enhanced by promises that such research would offer new treatments for a host of very, very serious ailments. The floor debated was framed in a starkly emotional terms, particularly by opponents of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, who liken the process to abortion because human embryos would be destroyed. Now others are saying, look, we're primarily using embryos that were from fertility clinics that were going to be cast aside anyway. But there are another number of other people are very encouraged about using stem cells from umbilical cords. We've talked to some doctors on the program before, and a lot of people believe that's the way we should go, using stem cells from umbilical cords. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the man blamed for some of the bloodiest insurgent attacks in Iraq, has been wounded, apparently, according to a militant website. The militant group al-Qaeda in Iraq did not give any further details, but urged Muslims to pray for his recovery. The Jordanian-born Zarqawi has claimed scores of attacks against civilians and the security forces, as well as the kidnapping and beheading of foreigners. The authenticity of the statement not yet verified. U.S. officials in Iraq were also unable to confirm the report. He is the most wanted suspect in Iraq, with a U.S. bounty of $25 million on his head, but he may be injured. A car bomb exploded next to a U.S. Army convoy in Baghdad on Tuesday, killing three soldiers, while another American died in a drive-by shooting a half hour later. Their deaths now push the number of U.S. troops killed in 3 days to 14, part of a surge in attacks that have also killed about 60 Iraqis. And as we speak right now, we have close to 1,000 soldiers and Marines are conducting a major exercise, a major offensive in western Iraq right now. Computer users, already anxious about viruses and identity theft, now have reason to worry again. Hackers apparently have found a way to lock up the electronic documents on your computer and then demand $200 over the internet to get them back. The ransom note left behind on one of them included an email address, and the attacker using the address later demanded $200 for the digital keys to unlock the files. The Mars rover Spirit apparently has found evidence now of a violent past history on Mars. They've discovered several layers of rocks in a hilly region of the red planet that suggest a very wet and very violent history in the planet's early life. As you know, a number of scientists have theorized, including Richard C. Hoagland, that some major catastrophic event had occurred on Mars billions of years ago. The six-wheeled robot has been examining rocks from three outcrops in the Gusev crater region that show possible deposits of water-altered debris from what they call simply explosive events. I had the opportunity tonight to preview a program that is going to be on the National Geographic Channel, and let me tell you something. It's called Extraterrestrial, and it is one of the finest shows I have seen in a long time. In a moment, Seth Shostak from SETI and Lawrence Doyle, Dr. Lawrence Doyle, as we talk about the search for extraterrestrial life and this program that'll be coming up very soon. Back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's called Extraterrestrial, premiering Monday, May 30th from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time on the National Geographic Channel. It's a groundbreaking new show that creates two worlds which scientists believe could exist in our own Milky Way galaxy, putting evolution into motion to investigate what life forms could survive there, and utilizing a combination of computer-generated imaging and 3D effects, Extraterrestrial takes viewers on a dazzling galactic journey to come face-to-face with these fantastic alien life forms. And again, had a chance to preview the program tonight, and it was fantastic. Two guests this hour. First, of course, Seth Shostak, the senior astronomer for SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He's responsible for much of the outreach activities of the Institute. He edits the newsletter, oversees the website, gives talks, writes magazine articles about SETI, also teaches a half a dozen informal educational classes on astronomy, and of course is a regular guest on Coast to Coast AM. Seth, how are you?
Just fine, George.
Hey, what a great show, by the way.
Did you like that?
Oh my gosh, I can't wait to talk with you and Dr. Lawrence Doyle about it. Dr. Doyle is a principal investigator with the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. He has been with SETI since 1987, where his main projects have included photometric detection of extrasolar planets. He is a visiting lecturer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, teaching classes on life in the universe and light and optics. Dr. Doyle is also president of Planet Quest, which is a recently started nonprofit corporation that will bring planet detection capability to all of us. Dr. Doyle attended San Diego State University. After receiving his bachelor and master science degrees, he worked as an engineer with the Voyager spacecrafts and the Space Image Processing Group at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, and he received his PhD from the University of Heidelberg in 1987. He's our guest this hour, too. Hello, Dr. Doyle. How are you?
Greetings. Fine. Thanks for having me on.
Great. We'll turn both your mics up, Seth and Dr. Doyle. And first of all, Seth, this program, and again, is speculation on what scientists could find, but it's pretty darn close, isn't it? You guys did a pretty thorough job trying to put together the alien life forms that might be out there somewhere, huh?
Well, we did. I mean, there's always been lots of speculation about what aliens might be like. But, you know, the first assumption was about the worlds themselves, because obviously there are lots of different worlds that could have life. Everybody thinks of Earth-like worlds. Well, these worlds are not exactly Earth-like, so that, you know, the producers wanted to take some worlds that are a little different, and there are two of them, as you've mentioned, that are depicted in the show. And so once we were given, you know, the kind of worlds that we were going to populate, then it was a question of saying, well, looking at the conditions on these worlds, what's possible, what's likely, what would they look like? And then the BBC animation unit ran amok and animated these guys.
Dr. Doyle, this takes us out into the future where scientists are looking at these worlds. But will they be found by real equipment, equipment that we've got now, equipment that we will be launching soon?
Well, these worlds that could potentially have life on them could be found, yes, within the next 20 years. The one is a tidally locked planet. That means it doesn't rotate as it goes around its star, and it's a dwarf red star. And the other one is a potentially habitable moon. But we should be able to detect Earth-like planets within the next, I would say, 8 years. And then within the next decade following that, we should be able to detect signs of biology in the atmosphere of certain nearby Earth-like planet.
Okay, now what we didn't find, at least at this point in this program, we didn't find extraterrestrials running around like us. They look primarily to be animals or creatures. Now, that's still pretty dramatic all by itself. But are we at a point now, Dr. Doyle, where maybe we are very unusual here on the planet, that maybe there's a special design on why we are here? Or do you believe that eventually we're going to stumble across other planets as well that have our kinds of life forms, like us?
Well, I think like us, you mean technology, and you know, animals do use tools and they do communicate, and some of the communication systems are rather complex, but we're the only spacefaring critters on this planet. And it could be that to a combination of astronomy, communication, and tool making could evolve on other planets to make technology that would also be detectable. In other words, it makes sense at least to hypothesize that what happened here could happen out there, given the, you know, gazillion planets that could exist and many millions of planets like Earth that could exist in the galaxy. It's worth pointing a radio telescope, because radio, for example, is the cheapest way to try and detect that technology. So I would say, for my studies, I haven't run into any showstoppers so far.
Seth, these two worlds, Aurelia and Blue Moon, really actually haven't been found yet, right?
No, that's correct. They haven't been. They're too small to have been found so far. But, you know, as Lawrence just said, the chances that these exist are extraordinarily high because, you know, planets are probably like animals. There are a lot more small ones than big ones. And we know there are a lot of big ones. I was talking with Jeff Marcy, who's an astronomer who's probably found more planets than any other human being on this planet. And I asked him, I said, you know, you've found more than 150 planets around other stars. Jeff, what's your best guess as to the percentage of stars that probably do have planets? And he said, you know, maybe 90%. Now, we don't know that yet, but that's his estimate. And if that's the case, then one thing you can say for sure, there are more planets out there than there are stars. So there are going to be planets like Aurelia and Blue Moon. Blue Moon is not a planet, it's a moon, but it's a moon that's big, and it hosts life. They're going to be out there.
Seth, back about 4 years ago, when you and I just started talking on Coast to Coast, and you said something that I never forgot because of the similarities of things that might be out there in the universe. You used a phrase that we believe that it's the same soup, that what we have on Earth could very well be what's on other planets and other areas in this universe. And by watching this this special that's going to be on, and it's going to be an ongoing, or was it just a one-timer, by the way?
They would like to do more, but at the moment it's a one-shot.
Okay. What I found interesting in this program is it looks like we're talking about the same soup again, which means creatures that have eyes, they have a mouth, they have a nose, they react differently, of course, because of their own environment, but they're also very similar to earthbound creatures. It's beginning to look like that's the same throughout the entire universe, isn't it?
Well, you know, of course, we're still extrapolating, but I think that makes sense because, for example, one of these two worlds, and it's the Blue Moon world, but it doesn't matter, has a very thick atmosphere, an atmosphere that's many times thicker than ours. Okay, well, that means that it's much easier to fly. It also turns out there's more oxygen in that atmosphere. So, you know, you get more out of your food. You can have a higher octane fuel, as it were, and that means, you know, you're also more efficient if you're flying. So it's an obvious conclusion that in a world like that, yes, you're going to fly, but it's going to be heavier things. You know, pigs could fly on a world like that. Well, they don't have flying pigs in the show, but they do have flying whales, things that weigh the same as hippos. And you might think, oh, that's just sci-fi. That's somebody's imagination. Well, no, it's actually just thought out biological engineering based on what we know. And it's very probable that these sorts of things will exist.
Dr. Doyle, what is beginning to change the mindset of scientists now, where more of them than less are beginning to believe that there could very well be life forms out there in the universe?
Well, I think the support, once NASA started the astrobiology program, there was actually fiscal support for studies. I think the interest in life in the universe was out there, but it was a little bit latent because it didn't have financial support. But when NASA started astrobiology and some other programs, they started to provide large-scale support for scientists who already had this intrinsic interest. So it's something that SETI's been doing for 20 years, so SETI Institute kind of led the way. But basically, it's there's been support because suddenly there was this interest in exobiology, and including Mars and all the way out to potentially habitable planets. And there's the upcoming NASA missions in the next couple decades that will specifically be designed to detect life in around other stars. So I think it's basically been the support that's changed. I think the scientists have always been interested, but now they actually can get some support to do these kind of researches, and it's caused a renaissance in the whole perspective of bioastronomy.
On both of these planets in the television program, we're talking about 5 billion years of evolution, so it's very close to Earth, a little older than Earth, but it's very close. Yet we have somehow evolved a little faster than what I saw in this television program. What's the reason for that? Why didn't the producers, why didn't the group of scientists take it the full distance and put intelligent life like us on these two worlds? Lawrence?
Well, I think they basically tried to take something that was maybe considered, at least for a habitable world, somewhat typical. And I don't think technology will necessarily be typical because, of course, we've only had it for, you know, stretching a point for the last couple thousand years. And there's been life on Earth for the last, you know, couple billion that's actually complex. And so, you know, I think that they were taking something rather typical, and that was complex biology may be much more common than actually technological expertise. That's a jump that we haven't filled in yet.
Seth, do you echo that?
Well, yes. I think that there were other considerations as well. And one is that as soon as you introduce an intelligent species, of course you change the whole nature of the program because your interest is going to be in those intelligent species. And there'll be no time for all these other things, right? You're going to want to know, hey, can we get in touch with these guys? It's a different kind of show. But you know what? One thing that is interesting, you mentioned, George, that these worlds are both figured to be about 5 billion years old, but one of them is around a red dwarf star that was mentioned at the beginning of the show. Now, red dwarf stars are just, you know, little runty guys that are maybe half the mass of the sun, but they're much dimmer than the sun, maybe 10 times dimmer than the sun, it depends, but that means that they go through their fuel much slower. Okay, so they will burn for 100 billion years, whereas the sun will only burn for about 10 billion years. So you can imagine that a planet that has life around one of those little guys is going to have a 100 billion year run. Imagine what it could do in that length of time.
How exciting would it be for scientists if they found a planet or a moon that just had, let's say, plant vegetation, maybe trees and some specialized plants and animals, much like we saw on these two worlds? I mean, would they jump for joy with just that kind of a find?
Oh, absolutely. I would drop my knickers. Yeah. That's the of course you would. Of course,
yeah, there'd be a lot of knickers around, I'd say.
Seth, you may be the only one whose knickers we don't want to drop.
Well, that's for sure. But, George, think back to 1996, the biggest science news story of the entire year was the claim made by a couple of NASA scientists that they'd found dead microbes on Mars.
Right.
Right.
That piece of rock that came here, right?
Right, that Martian meteorite. And those aliens were dead. They weren't trees and plants. And as it turns out, it probably wasn't life anyhow. And yet it was the biggest science news story of the year. So just imagine if we could prove that, hey, there are forests on some world over there. I mean, people would, it would knock everybody's collective hosiery off. How's that?
You know, Lawrence, they said in the television program that in the not-too-distant future, we may very well find these kinds of worlds. Realistically, when do you think this could happen?
Yes, I think certainly the Kepler project, which will detect Earth-like planets around sun-like stars, will be launched in 2008, and by about 2015, we should have a collection of Earth-like planets if they're moderately common. And so I would say within the next 10 years, we'll have Earth in hand. And then the following decade, 2012 to 2015, somewhere around there, the Terrestrial Planet Finder, SIM Planet Quest, and Darwin, the European Space Agency missions, are all going to be launched. And they're basically, their goal is to detect any kind of disequilibria in the atmosphere of potentially habitable planets. Like, for example, oxygen reacts so quickly that it shouldn't be free in an atmosphere, and yet oxygen's floating around our atmosphere, and that's more or less proof that there are photosynthetic plants producing it. So you get ozone and oxygen and things like that, and you have a pretty good idea there's a forest working on that planet.
That's going to be exciting. Seth, you stay with us because we're going to take phone calls when we come back at the half hour. Dr. Doyle, I want to thank you for being part of the program with us. Very exciting. And again, this program is going to be on the National Geographic Channel on May 30th from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time. We'll be back with Seth Shostak. We'll take questions of him. And by the way, Lex has posted some real cool stuff that's part of this television program that you'll see on the coasttocoastam.com website, as well as an incredible photo of some storm clouds in Missouri. Take a look at one of them. It looks like Richard Nixon.
And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time.
From somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Is the military secretly working on back engineering ET craft? Are alien hybrids alive in Mexico? These are just two of the fascinating topics uncovered by guest editor Lex Lonehood for the After Dark June UFO special. To order that and pick up 14 issues for the price of 12, you call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or simply go online at www.coasttocoastam.com. You know, of all the creatures, Seth, that they had on those two planets, the moon and the other planet, the one that really scared me was that hysteria, that gook that came out of the sea and gobbled up one of those animals. That was an awful creature, whatever
like,
it is.
Kind of like miniature piranha.
Yeah, and really working in mass.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, there are a lot of social insects kind of prototypes that were taken over for this show. There are a couple of critters that are based on, you know, wasps and bees and ants and so forth, because that's a good way to organize yourself. Nobody has to be very smart, but the whole hive can act in a very clever way.
Hey, I'm told that a couple scientists, by the way, don't think wormholes will be ever able to be used to travel through space. That's kind of disappointing to me.
Well, they've been saying that for a long time. Don't give up. I mean, that's been said for 30 years, that wormholes exist on blackboards only, And, you know, they're going to be little tiny wormholes, but you'll never be able to get anything through it. And maybe that's the case, but keep in mind, we've only even considered wormholes as a possibility for the last a few decades. What? Something like a few decades. Our minds might change in the next couple of hundred years.
All right, well, let's take some phone calls while we have you for this half hour. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
We are fine. And where are you calling from?
McAllen, Texas.
Great, go ahead.
Hey, I'm really really happy to be talking to you guys. Hey, listen, what about teleportation?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing on teleportation is we don't know how to do it. See, I mean, there are various possibilities. You could try...
There was this show the other night about teleportation, and they were saying that it was possible, though.
Well, here's the kind of thing you could imagine doing, see. You could try it the way they do it in Star Trek. Remember when they would beam you down to a planet? And if you read the Star Trek technical manuals, which, by the way, is very hard to do because, of course, it's all fiction, but, you know, you read them, and what they do is they sort of take you apart atom by atom or molecule by molecule, and then they send those atoms or molecules down to the planet where they're put back together somehow, right? Now, the trouble with that is if there's a cloud in the way or something, you know, you might arrive a little mixed up, and that could ruin your whole day. The other way to do it is maybe what you do is instead of sending the atoms or the molecules, you just sort of read out where they all are, right? Oh, here's a hydrogen atom, and here's a carbon atom, and so forth, whatever. In principle, you might imagine reading out where everything is in your body and then sending that on a radio or a light beam to some place where it's put back together. Now, the trouble with that is if you could do it, and there are real problems with doing that, but if you could do it, then we could just tape record you and then beam you again and again and again and again, and we could make a whole army of just you, super cloning, and people don't like that idea. But so far, I would say don't count on teleportation. Invest in airline stocks.
Seth, what's new in the world of SETI, by the way?
Well, I think that some of the most interesting things involve the construction of our new Allen telescope array. We've got 10 antennas standing up there in the Cascades of Northern California, and, you know, that's 10 out of 350, but by the end of this year, it'll be more like 40, and we'll actually be using it to scan the inner part of the Milky Way where, you know, stars are more clotted than King Island cream, I guess, you know, that's a good thing to do because where you have lots of stars, you have a better chance of finding something.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Where might you be calling from? Hi.
Good morning, George and company, calling
Hi.
From Toronto, Ontario.
Well,
as a sidebar, George, I'd like to see Richard C. Hoagland and Jonathan Evans, the guest you had on not too long ago, brought together to develop what I've come to call an extraterrestrial objects roadshow or an ETO roadshow, like an antiques roadshow. But if anyone knows whether or not an object found on this planet is extraterrestrial, Jonathan Evans could do that. And I think this would put the study of these objects on the map and be a boon to your show because I quite frankly feel a lot of people would call in. I have thought for years of planets that are covered with water. We did have a hope of a show that really got into that, water world, but that turned out to be a dud and it really didn't look at some of the possibilities out there. But then there was a revelation on a show a few months ago here where in our solar system no activity is going on except in the atmosphere. And I thought, is it possible to have activity in our atmosphere on a planet? Your mantle is too hot, there's not enough water, or whatever's going on is only going on in the atmosphere. And I thought, could you develop a civilization of creatures that only live in the atmosphere?
Yeah,
to get their food and their sustenance from that.
Yeah, good question. I mean, you know, life would be a gas. That's actually been... It's been proposed. In fact, if you look back in some of the books written by Carl Sagan, you'll see that he actually wrote a paper on this, I believe, where he said, look, consider Jupiter, for example. Jupiter has an atmosphere that's 10,000 miles deep, which is, you know, certainly beats ours. And it's, you know, mostly things like methane and ammonia and other things you use to clean the bathroom. But there are a lot of course, organic chemicals in that atmosphere, and he suggested that maybe you could have some sort of floating life in that atmosphere. Now, we've sent a probe down through the atmosphere of Jupiter a couple of years ago. The Galileo spacecraft took a probe and dropped it in, and it didn't find any sign that there was any life down there. But at least it was a possibility. Another place that might conceivably have life without it being on the surface or in any ocean at all, is on Venus. There's a guy in Colorado that has David Grinspoon. He's been on this show.
Yes.
Who's talked about, you know, floating life in the atmosphere of Venus. So your idea is a good one.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. I really like the Blue Moon segment. Of course, I liked them all, but those huge flying whales that were just sucking up the organisms in the atmosphere, those things were neat.
Yeah.
And also very possible, I guess, huh?
Well, they certainly, yeah, they would fly. I mean, those sorts of things would fly. And if you have life in the atmosphere, as the Blue Moon does, it has, you know, kind of like algae in the atmosphere, it's... As one of the scientists there said, it's a giant larder up there. It's a big supermarket, so you're going to have grazers. And they can't be cows because cows can't fly. But these were, you know, flying whales, which in this case could fly, and they just graze on this stuff. And if you have that, then you have meat on the wing, and you'll probably have something predating on the you know, trying to chew on the whales.
Well, and what I got from watching this preview today, Seth, is that whatever these creatures end up being, they are adapting to their environment. When, you know, with our knowledge of today and Earth, we say, well, that thing can't exist. That's not true. These creatures somehow are adapting to their very specialized circumstances, and that I found to be very fascinating.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the idea, that doggone it, if you have a planet where the conditions are really radically different, the life is going to do things that never occurred to you.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with Seth Sostak on Coast to Coast AM. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Seth.
Hi.
I just had a comment about the frequency range you're listening to for alien life. Wouldn't you want to listen at 800 kilohertz, say, or 5 megahertz initially, or maybe even the FM broadcast band? Isn't that where life, these possible alien life forms would begin to broadcast?
Well, I don't know. Why are you saying 800 kilohertz? Is that where you're picking up this show?
Oh, yeah, CKLW. Sure, yep. That's right. But I'm just saying, for instance, we all started off, you know, with spark gap transmitters and then AM modulation, then FM modulation in the lower frequency range. Right. And I understand it'd be really difficult to do it on Earth, but perhaps a large dish on the backside of the moon might work.
Yeah, well, there's some truth in that. We don't listen at these very low frequencies, the frequencies of AM broadcast, for example. In fact, we don't listen on any frequencies that are lower than about, well, what are used for television and FM on this planet. Now, part of the reason, in fact, largely the reason, is that the ionosphere makes it very difficult for those frequencies to get through. Okay, so that's just, if you will, a small technical problem that you could solve by removing the atmosphere or something like that, which, you know, will run into opposition from the locals. So what you do is, indeed, you'd have to move the antennas off Earth. But, you know, the higher up the dial you go, you probably know this, the higher up the dial you go, the more information you can send. It's like getting a better modem. And so my thought is that we really ought to go to higher frequencies.
Seth, after you saw this program, what did you come away with? What did you like the best of this show?
Well, you know, it has a lot of drama. It's kind of like walking with dinosaurs, except walking with aliens, right? So, you know, there's the drama of what they do to one another and this, that, and the other. That's all very interesting, of course. But to me, what really struck me about this was that they made some attempt to imagine aliens as they might really be, as opposed to the kind of aliens you'll see in the movies. I mean, you know, R2-D2, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of,
that's true.
I mean, those are, you know, fun aliens, and they interact with us and this, that, and the other. But these were aliens in a truly realistic sense. They were truly alien. They were quite different from anything you normally see. And it wasn't just little, you know, intelligent, smooth-skinned guys that were walking around without any accompaniment. These were the critters that lived on these planets. It wasn't the intelligent ones. It was just the wildlife on planets that really could exist. So there was that element of, well, this could be. It could be happening right now as we're having this conversation.
I did notice, but there are predators on every planet, on every moon. No matter where we seem to go, it seems like this universe lives by eating each other or doing whatever they have to do that way.
Well, yes, it's not pleasant if you're the prey, but you got to look at it this way. Look, you need a whole bunch of molecules, you know, organic molecules to do your job. And, you know, there are a bunch of plants out there collecting energy for you, this sunlight and so forth and so on. And you could just stand out in the sun and try and be like a plant. you know, and convert sunlight and air and water into sugar and stuff. But the plants have done it already. It's a lot faster to collect what they've done and just eat the plants. But what turns out to be faster yet is to eat something that's already eaten the plants. And so predation, where you chow down on, you know, higher life forms, is always going to be a feature of life because it's a very efficient way to get what you need.
Seth, there are some days I'm not sure I'm using all my molecules at all, to tell you the truth. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. How are y'all doing tonight?
We're doing fine. Where are you calling from, by the way?
From Texas.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, just hearing about the last episode a couple nights ago about finding the little telescopes, would we be able to port into previous space stations, maybe used by the Egyptians?
Well, you were breaking up right at the end there. Want to try that one more time?
Okay. You know that we're finding the small telescopes used for teleportation from previous, in the Egyptian and the history. Well, I was wondering, since we have these teleports, would we be able to teleport into the future? Oh, not into the future, but into
Okay, well, I'm going to let you take a little futuristic answer to that, Seth. I don't think we have found teleportation devices on this planet yet.
Not that I know of. If we have, man, you know, I'm selling a lot of stock.
I would love to find one, though, wouldn't you?
Well, it would be great if you could do that. I mean, if there really was. And we talked a little bit about wormholes here this half hour. And, of course, that's the great promise of wormholes, that in some sense they really are teleportation. You go in one end and you come out somewhere completely different, maybe the other side of the universe, and it doesn't take any time at all. But whether they could actually work or not, of course, is the problem.
East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Seth on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
What sort of aggravates me is people who are talking about how perfect a planet would have to be to support life, how Earth-like it would have to be, because we couldn't survive someplace. And when you look right here on Earth at the phenomenal variety of life-sustaining systems that go on, even this stuff down at the bottom of the ocean that live off of chemical flumes, the idea that we have to look for a planet that's very much like ours just amazes me. I don't understand that mentality. The one thing that I can't understand is why, with the places on Earth that have insect swarms so thick, why we haven't found seining birds, sort of like flying. What got me to thinking of this was the flying whale idea. Why haven't we found birds that just seine these clouds of insects in that same way? But this idea that we need to find conditions like ours rather than looking for things that survive in other conditions is just what surprises me.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you'd said all that 15 years ago, you probably would have gotten tenure at some major university just for saying it, because that's exactly the kind of thinking that's going on today, that it doesn't have to be like Earth. And I think that there are two developments that have led us to sort of change our mind on that. One is finding that there are other worlds, even in our own solar system, that could have life that are really not like Earth at all. And the most obvious example is Jupiter's moon, Europa, which, you know, is covered with this big ocean, but it's not like the Earth. There are no continents. It's just a huge, deep ocean covered with a big frosty cap. But that might have life on it. Okay, so there were these habitats. But the other thing was that we found out exactly what you're talking about, that there is life on this planet that can survive in extreme conditions. They're called extremophiles, and indeed, there's some thermophiles, which are kind of extremophile, at the bottom of the ocean, just where you were talking about, which live in water that's way above the boiling temperature. It's like 113, even maybe 115 degrees, that's centigrade. Okay, you have to convert for Fahrenheit, but that's above boiling. They're happy as, well, I won't say clams, because clams wouldn't be happy, but they're happy living in that condition. There are also extremophiles that can live in extraordinarily cold conditions, below freezing. So these are the kinds of earthly critters that if you transplanted them to places like Mars or some of the moons of Jupiter, some of these guys could survive. And that's why people study these extremophiles, because they figure, hey, this is the closest we're going to find to aliens here on Earth.
What did you think of everything we found here on Titan, the methane oceans and everything else?
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, Titan, to land on Titan, this is the farthest place we've ever landed, right? And you know, you look at those pictures and you say, well, it kind of looks like, you know, maybe parts of Greenland or northern Canada or something like that. There's something eerily familiar about it all, but you have to stop and think that all those what look like lakes or oceans and riverbeds and so forth, that's not water running down there. That's, you know, that's liquid natural gas, if you will. So it's kind of hard to, maybe if you turn the air conditioning way up, but I think it's just spectacular, absolutely spectacular stuff.
Final call, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is Dean from Cedar City.
Hey, Dean, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'd like to ask about, I believe it was Dr. Doyle was saying that we're the only space-faring civilization on the Earth, but haven't they said in the news recently that you were just talking about the nematodes, the extremophiles and such, that these are thrown up into space by volcanic eruptions and actually travel through space. And also that book that was written, like the where the virus came down from space, it's an older book, I can't remember the name of it right now, Germana Strain. And if you look at viruses and such, they're actually more complex than even our civilization.
Oh, no doubt. You know, Seth, that is a real possibility one day, by the way, that a virus can hit us. You know, and sometimes I'm not so sure that, you know, we're probably being bombarded with viruses now, some of these new diseases we get hit with. Who's to say they didn't hit us from space, huh?
Well, there are people who have suggested that. The only thing is, a virus, you know, is kind of a parasitic critter. You know that viruses invade your cells and then make more viruses, but they're very dependent on the machinery of the cell they invade. So a virus from space would probably not be very happy invading one of our cells because the machinery is all different. I don't think you have to worry too much about that.
All right, Seth, thank you again so much. This program, of course, Monday, May 30th, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Pacific Time. Fascinating, well worth watching. Seth, take care of yourself, my friend, okay?
Okay, thanks very much, George.
And I'll be back in a moment with our guest, Dr. Eric Fisher, as we talk about past life regression and some other things right here on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. Just one love.